Esther 2. Well, here's in this chapter where we meet Esther for the first time. And what are we to make of her? It's sort of in Sunday school Christianity, Esther is sort of put up as this faithful girl who, with great faith, saved God's people. And yes, she did have faith, I think, in the end. But I don't think she was some spiritually minded, holy, pious young woman. I mean, the name God, or the word God, as you know, never occurs, certainly not in the Hebrew text of Esther. It's implicit, but it is not there. Because God was working through human weakness, through situations, etc., rather than so directly. Mordecai is a form of Marduk, the god of the Persians. And so you could say that he was sort of pretty well kind of taken up with material life there in Persia. He'd assimilated, he was working in the palace, he was a government man. And Esther, well, he brought up Hadassah, Esther 2, verse 7. That is Esther. Well, Hadassah means myrtle. If you go to Israel today, you'll see myrtle trees, but myrtles are not a native of Israel. And I don't believe that there were myrtle trees in Israel at the time. Myrtles were a native of Persia. And I think the fact that she's named after a myrtle tree, a local tree from Persia, I think that says something. We sort of rather expect her to have some wonderfully sort of spiritual name, you know, Hannah, you know, Grace of Yah or something, but no, not at all. And her other name was Esther, which means a star, and Marduk was the star. So she is presented as a totally secular, good-looking young Jewess, but of course he says to her, well, you know, when you go for this job, don't tell them you're a Jewess, will you? Just keep that under your hat. So she acted like a Persian girl, and she was accepted as a Persian. And as we know, it's actually out of that weakness that God worked in order to save his people through her. When she comes out and basically says to the king, you know what, if you wipe out the Jews, you're going to wipe me out, because I am a Jew, I'm a Jewess. And she had hidden that. But she hid it initially because of weakness. And I would say that Mordecai, because he worked for the king, he was pushing her to go in for this competition, as it were, to become one of the king's wives. Don't think that when he divorced with Vashti that the poor guy was like this old single guy who was really grateful to meet some young woman to marry. Not at all. He had stacks of women. And in fact, this whole incident when Esther is chosen doesn't happen for about 5 years after the thing with Vashti, because in Esther 2:16 it says that Esther was taken to Ahasuerus in the 10th month in the 7th year of his reign. Well, the Vashti thing was 5 years before that. And she has to spend 12 months being prepared to be the king's wife, taking all these various beauty treatments and so forth. And the whole system was obviously set up. This guy called Hegai, who is basically in charge of meeting the king's various sexual whims, he gets all these maidens gathered together, looked after by him, prepared by him, and then she is given 7 beautiful young girls to go in with her to the king. Well, it says that she went in unto the king. I think we are supposed to read that as how that normally reads in the Bible. A man goes into a woman, or a woman goes into a man, and lo and behold, she gets pregnant. So you can take that as a euphemism. And she doesn't actually take the 7 young women with her. I mean, basically, they would have put on, you can imagine, some sort of orgy, some sort of sexual thing for the king. She goes in to the king in the evening, strangely enough, and in the morning she comes out and she is put then into a separate house. And this is clearly an organized system
that they were supposed to, that these virgins will gather together prepared, and they go in unto the king. And once he slept with them, even if he doesn't choose them, they're not supposed to sleep with anybody else, so they are, you know, condemned to a pretty miserable life in this other house. And I think it's significant that she doesn't take the seven girls with her. And I suppose the upshot of that was that he was focused solely upon her. Maybe that's why he liked her and chose her, or whatever. Maybe this had been going on ever since Vashti had been divorced 5 years before, and he, well, hadn't actually chosen anyone out of all these sex evenings, basically, that he had with these women. But with this one, he did like her. Maybe because she came in on her own, which could possibly be an indicator of some sort of morality in her. Well, I personally doubt it. But anyway, the point is that, I mean, what sort of behaviour is this for a young woman who claims to be a believer in God? I mean, I don't think she was much of a believer. And also, she is purposefully contrasted with Daniel, because she's prepared for this meeting with the king, and she's given this Haggai, this guy who's sort of got to train her up, and that's exactly what happened to Daniel and his three friends. But they, of course, put their foot down and said, we're not even eating anything that's been offered to idols, we're not going to eat the king's meat, etc. Whereas she goes along absolutely with everything that she's asked to do. And as I say, I think the contrast with Daniel, another young man in a similar situation, is intentional. So it says in verse 9 that Haggai gave her cosmetics and her portions of food, just the same with Daniel, but she refused them. Sorry, but he refused them and she accepted them. So I think that the whole story here is to show us how God works with secular people. And you think of King Saul, that he was out looking for lost cattle. He was clearly not a spiritual man. When his servant says, well, we can't find him, let's go to the prophet. And Saul says, oh, don't you like have to pay holy people? I'm sure Samuel wasn't like that at all. He was glad to see whoever wanted to come for teaching. And when they come into the town, they ask some girls, where's the prophet? And they say, oh, well, it's a feast day today. And Saul's like, oh, is it? You know, he wasn't a religious guy. He wasn't keeping the Jewish feasts. And then they bump into Samuel, didn't recognize him, say, hey, sorry, mate, do you know where the prophet is? And he's like, well, I'm the prophet. Oh, really? So, you know, Saul could have made it spiritually. He could have been almost the messianic anointed king. But he didn't in the end, but that was possible, and he was called to do that. And so I think it is the same with Esther, although here is a case of somebody who makes it, that she does respond to God's nudges all the way through. And this is encouragement for us, because we live in a world of secular people. Let's face it, the majority of people in our lives, in the workplace, or place of study, school or whatever, are not believers. They are secular people. And you may think that it's hopeless, that how on earth can you interest these people? Well, yeah, God wants all people to be saved. And likewise, when you look at the weakness of some of those who are your fellow baptized believers, you may think, well, they're so sort of secular, they're so worldly in the way they are, way they think, carry on. Yeah, that's how they are. But God is working with people, and he doesn't give up. And what about you? What about me? Are we much better? I mean, are we as strong as Daniel was, or are we more like Esther? I think we are more like Esther. And yet God will keep working with you whilst you wish to remain in the program with him. And there's always this higher hand in life, like Mordecai happened to find out about Bigthan and Teresh trying to kill the king, and that was noted down, but the king forgets to reward him. And that was just providence, and it was going to become used by God. So that higher hand in human life is there with you and me. And it's all working ultimately towards the final salvation, if we want to go along with it. Although, as I say, the name of God or Yahweh is not found at all in Esther. And likewise, God is working in a very discreet kind of way. This is not the age of miracles. This is the age of the hand of providence. In the lives of ordinary secular people like you and me, as we once were, whom God wishes to work with and to bring about a beautiful salvation.